Possible Poetry, ein Podcast über neue Welten und Wege in der Poesie mit Dirk Hülstrunk. Possible Poetry, a podcast about new worlds and roads of poetry with your host Dirk Hülstrunk. So you are listening to episode 8 of Possible Poetry, a podcast about new worlds and paths of poetry. This episode will be in English. My name is Dirk Hülstrunk and it's a real privilege that I'm able to meet and talk to poets from around the globe in this international podcast. And I'm very happy that my podcast is now also part of the literaturpodcast.de poetry community, or actually literature community, podcast community, but it's only in German, unfortunately. Today, our podcast is zooming to London to meet with Iris Kollamb, a truly interdisciplinary and unique artist, a poet, performer, improviser, curator, editor, and translator. Iris is seeking possibilities beyond the traditional format of poetry readings, which makes her a great match for the Possible Poetry podcast. So welcome, Iris Kollamb, to this podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Great that we have this podcast across the channel, as we say, because sometimes I think the channel is quite a divide between like the continental and also the German artist and poetry community and the English-speaking or Anglo-American community. Do you feel this way as well?
I mean, that's quite a loaded question for me because I'm French. And so because I've been living here for 10 years, I was already here when Brexit happened. So the channel really expanded right before my eyes when that happened. But yeah, there was always a sense that English people or British people would often talk about how, oh, this is very continental or like very European. And there was already a sense that they didn't really feel kind of like part of Europe before that happened. And I guess that's like a, yeah, that's something that would come up in kind of like cultural conversations. It's not really specific to art, but it's definitely something that's kind of present, I'd say.
And do you see yourself as some kind of a cultural messenger between continent and Britain, or is that doesn't really matter to you that much?
Well, that's a good question. I guess for me, although I'm a French person because I was born in France and my parents are French, I think I'm more of a British poet. I think like all of my influences are much more from the English-speaking parts of the world. You know, I started writing poetry after moving to the UK as opposed to moving from one sort of poetry world to another. It all kind of happened here. I'm definitely part of this island.
One of the reasons I invited you because your work is so diverse and going, starting maybe from poetry, but going so many different directions. You also work with many collaborations with collectives. You've been a resident poet as at the Center for Recent Drawing, which is also interesting. Why is a poet at a center of drawing?
Oh, so this residency was in 2017, and it was it came from a connection. It was like a joint project between the Center for Recent Drawing and the Poetry School. And so they came together to kind of like organize this residency. And I think there were maybe six of us who were kind of working in this space, which is in Highbury and Islington, for people who know London geography. But it's a pretty central part of London, and the poets slash artists or the poet artists or whatever were sort of offered an opportunity to work in that space and to produce work that was between the textual and the visual.
You're also co-editor of the HVTN Press. I think it's a kind of a special edition you're curating there.
So yeah, HVTN or Haverthorne is a small press that I'm co-editor of with Andrew Wells. Yes, it was just before the first lockdown that I started Interruptions, which is an imprint within Haverthorne, and it's an artist book imprint. And my goal with this imprint was to create a space Well, so for poets who produced works which were supposed to exist in a really specific format, which couldn't fit, into Haverthorne's house style, the experiments beyond the traditional codex form. The idea was to help these poets to produce editions of artist books, which they wouldn't be able to self-publish because of like possibly budget issues, but also it's kind of nice to be able to have an artist book that's not self-published, and kind of rare. So, and the idea is that it was a kind of like an interruption within within Haverthorne's sort of like catalog.
So you're also a founder and curator of the investigative poetry platform Slant. That sounds interesting too, especially investigative poetry platform. So what do you investigate there?
Slant was like a program of events, each focusing on a specific kind of aspect of poetry performance, and everything was to do with the idea of really diving into liveness and poetry. There were four events that I curated with four different co-curators. The first one was all about voice. It was called Voice Works, and I co-curated it with Serena Bryda. And then there was one which was all about systems and process-led poetry performances, which I developed with Javier Velastin. And then after that, there was one that was all about movement and poetry performance, which I developed with Camilla Nelson, and that one was called Writing Bodies. And the last one, Spontaneous Combustion, was all about improvisation, and that was something I developed with Luna Montenegro and Adrian Fisher.
And there's also a couple of collaborations you're doing. We'll talk about that later. Maybe just one more thing. You're also working as a creative writing teacher, I saw, and now as a visiting lecturer in at the University of Rothschild. Is that that's also in London, is it?
Roehampton, yes.
Roehampton. Okay. Yeah.
Yes, yeah, I've been teaching at Roehampton for the last few years, and my main module that I teach there is called Writing, comma, Performance, comma, Art. It's a module that's all about mixing text with different art forms. So there's a session that's more focused on like visual art and text. Another one which is to do with sound and various approaches to mixing like text and performance. And so it's kind of introducing students to ways of experimenting beyond the confines of the page. Yeah, I guess the most important thing about that is, yeah, how to sort of like imagine how visual elements or sonic elements or performative elements can be used to add layers of meaning to textual works, which wouldn't be possible otherwise.
So after talking about some of the many projects you are involved in as a curator, as a teacher, but also as an artist, maybe we should present something of your performance work now in this podcast. And you suggested a little performance poem called Nothing Intensifies, which we are hearing right now.
There's nothing there, nothing to say. You have nothing to say, and you say it. There's nothing there, and you say it, and you say it, and it grows. Nothing there, you can hear it, you can feel it grow. Nothing there, nothing else. Nothing left to say. Nothing grows. Nothing sticks. Nothing lasts. Nothing fits. Nothing in it. Nothing to it. And you think nothing of it. Nothing there. Nothing really. Nothing yet. Still nothing.
nothing there to say, nothing else, and it grows. You have nothing to say, and you say it, and you say it again. And as you say it, nothing happens, and it happens again. Another drop of nothing drops, and every drop of nothing drops. Another shred of nothing shreds, and all the shreds of nothing shred. Another flicker of nothing flickers, and every flicker of nothing flickers. Nothing happens. You see it happen. You hear it happen. You let it happen. And as you let it, nothing happens again, and it does. And it grows, and you say it, and it spreads, and you say it, and it swells, and you say it again. And as it grows thicker, and as it grows stronger, and as it grows deeper, and you say it as it grows. And as it grows, you say it, and it grows. And as you say it, it grows, and as it grows, you say it. And as it grows, and as it grows, and as it grows till there's nothing, nothing left, nothing more to say. And as it grows, and as it grows, and as it grows, and there's nothing to make of it, nothing to see, and there's nothing, nothing in it, nothing in it for you. And as it grows, 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 and there's nothing, nothing left, nothing still to say. And you do it, and you do it, and you do it again. And you say it, and it happens, and it grows again. Nothing thicker, nothing stronger, nothing deeper, still. And as nothing comes to mind, and that nothing comes from nothing, there is nothing in your eyes, and your face says nothing. And as nothing grows around you, there is nothing you can do. There is nothing you can do, and you do just that. Nothing works, nothing matters, nothing certain, nothing lasts, and there's nothing in that nothing, and that nothing grows. Another drop of nothing drops, and every flicker of nothing flickers, another flicker of nothing flickers, and all the shreds of nothing shred, another shred of nothing shreds, and every drop of nothing drops, and there's nothing in that nothing, and in that nothing there is more. And as it grows, you feel it. You feel nothing. And it grows. You can hear it. You can see it. You can taste it as you say it. And that nothing turns to nothing. And there's nothing in it still. And you say it. And you say it. And you can't say it enough. And as you say it, you say it, you say it as you say it, but there's still so much nothing to be said. And as nothing comes from nothing, there is nothing else for it till there's so much nothing, you can hardly bear to say it. And as you say it, you feel it. You feel it as you say it. And as you feel it, you say it. You say it as you feel it. And as you say it, you say it. You say it as you say it. And you do it. And you do it. And you do it again. And you say it, and it happens, and it grows again. And as it grows, you say it as it grows, and as it grows, and as it grows, and as it grows, and you say it, but it grows, and you just can't say it all. And as you say it, you say it, you say it, as you say it, and as it grows, and as it grows, and as it grows, it grows. And it grows, as it grows, as it grows, as it grows. grows, and as it grows, you say it, you say it, and you feel it, and as you say it, you say it, you say it, as you say it, and as it grows, and as it grows, and as it grows, and it grows, as it grows, as it grows, as it grows, and as it grows, and as it grows, and as it grows, it grows, and it grows, as it grows, as it grows, as it grows, and as it grows, and as it grows, and as it grows, and it grows, as it grows, as it grows, as it grows, and as it grows, and as it grows, and as it grows, and it grows, as it grows, as it grows, as it grows, and as it grows, and as it grows, and as it grows, 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 and as it grows, and as it grows, and as it grows, it grows, and as it grows, and as it grows, and as it grows, it grows.
Yeah, now it's growing up. Yeah, that's kind of a very ironic, portrait of a poet, I would say, isn't it? A poetic work.
I guess it's really open to interpretation, this this piece. I've had different reactions to it in different contexts, and I think I quite like to play with repetition and iteration in ways that leave space for the audience to kind of project their own meaning onto the piece.
Well, definitely. I saw a poet at work, and and it was real. Well, it does have a visual element because there is some physical work involved. It's not just the language. You use a strange device I couldn't really identify. It does make some strange noises you could hear in the background.
It's a foot pump.
It's an air pump, is it? Okay.
The kind of pump you would use, to blow up a mattress, for example.
Ah, okay, I see. But you had to use some strength, some power to work it, and you could hear definitely also the strength you needed to speak it, and. It also brings me to the idea that some of your stuff is working with restraints, and maybe that's also some kind of restraints. Like you have a text, but then you have something that makes it difficult to read it or to perform it. And so this is also one of these things that.
Actually, it's interesting because recently I've been thinking about this piece and whether or not it fits within these reading constraint kind of experiments that I've been sort of developing over the years. And I do think that it does completely fit within that, because there is still, even though it's not as kind of as challenging and risky as some of the other pieces I have that kind of involve these constraints, it still definitely requires quite a lot of, resilience to get through the piece. And I am interested in that. But initially, the starting point for this piece was just staying over at a friend's house, blowing up the mattress with a pump that was exactly like this one. And I just kind of fell in love with this sound. And I thought, I absolutely have to write a poem for this sound.
And also the pump is really creating the rhythm, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to write something that would be a text that would only really work with the sound of the pump, that would, where both of these things would really be integrated. So the text is kind of a response to perhaps the sound of that pump, and then also the more visual sort of aspect of the performance, which involves, I guess, pumping into nothing. So it was also to do with that image. But I often start with an object or a form or a constraint I like to try, and then try to figure out what the text could be for that situation or for that sound. Sometimes it I wonder if this is the if I'm doing things the wrong way around, but no, because it's my way around.
That also brings you close to this the Ulipur movement, doesn't it? Which is also based in France actually. But what I could see that there are more working with restraints within the language, but you're using restraints that come out from outside the language somehow, from objects you're using or from other. I saw there was a one piece where you were bondaged somehow while you were reading, so that's a very obvious restraint.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so I've been collaborating with a rigger or shibari artist called Nick Yournaughts, who is a really dear friend of mine. I've pretty much been collaborating with him on through different media for the past 10 years, and it was only a few years ago that we thought, you know, because he had sort of gone off and discovered like rigging and like rope art, and I'd kind of gone off and done all of this kind of poetry and performance stuff. And you know, one day we were like, well, why don't we try and you know mix these two things together and see what can come out of these two art forms. And so that led to producing the first piece, which was In Dreams I've Had of Falling, which is just involves you know being tied and suspended with rope while reading, but in a position where I'm sort of sitting cross-legged, which you know in contrast to the next piece we did is quite comfortable. And then after that we produced a second piece called What We Hold, and this piece involves hanging upside down with the rope just tying my feet and reading upside down like that until the piece is finished. And while I'm reading, Nick is holding the rope, so that sort of piece has a strong kind of risk element, because the idea is that you know if he were to let go of the rope, I would fall. And that's something that's very much kind of integrated within that piece, in the sense that it also is a big part of what inspired the text, so the poem that I'm reading throughout the piece as
Yeah, I
well.
was just going to ask you, how important is the text then in this setting really? Could it be anything, or is there something you write specifically for this piece?
Yeah, it definitely couldn't be anything. So with these specific collaborations with Nick, we think of the sort of like the suspension side of it together first, then we experiment and try it out. And it's the physical experience of that situation of being tied and suspended in each of those ways that leads me to make creative decisions about the way the text is going to be produced, the materials I'm going to use to produce that text, and also the length of the text is also the situation itself is really the starting point, and the text is couldn't be read in any other situation. It has to be read in that context, because that's what it's kind of responding to. The first layer of meaning, I guess, that comes in with these pieces is that kind of physical situation and that collaborative suspension situation, and then that's what leads the text to come in with a different form of meaning making, I'd say.
I was just going to ask you what your idea of poetry actually is, because we always talk about poetry, and it seems like everyone seems to know what it is. But it's also something which is very open, and it's really hard to define what it actually is. Most people will think, yeah, it's some kind of written poem with stanzas and maybe some rhyme or rhythm or some structure to it. But what is poetry to you?
Yeah, that's a very big question.
I know.
It makes me think of so many things, but maybe one of the things I could mention first is that like I do tend to avoid the word poetry in those kinds of conversations, because I think that sometimes the word poetry can feel quite limiting. I guess like what I'm doing through my work is precisely that, is kind of like challenging the idea of like the form of the traditional form of the poem. So it makes me think more about like what poetic can be. So like sometimes I call my pieces like poetic performance pieces, but they're also poetry performances. I like to think in more of a sort of like transdisciplinary way beyond disciplines, because possibly it allows me to avoid trying to define what I think poetry is. And I guess it's because I'm more interested in kind of exploring possibilities and like pushing into, different sort of like disciplines, rather than focusing on what the essence of poetry is.
So it's not just the romantic idea of expressing some feelings you're having there.
I would say, that maybe poetry is, a language art, right? It's the situation in which language can be used. Yeah, even the word used feels weird, but for something which kind of can exceed communication. So I'm really interested in the materiality of language, whether it's like visual or sonic. For me, poetry is a situation in which language can almost start to do its own thing, because it's no longer tied to the things it's usually tied to, which are to do, with like direct communication, having a very clear message, like truth or untruth, whatever that is. All of these kinds of questions, it's a space in which language is freer than all the other places or spaces in which, or situations in which we are used to constantly encountering language.
So that kind of brings you closer to phenomena like concrete poetry or language poetry, I would say. We're using poetry as the, or language as material more, as a material aspect. So is that one of the your inspirations also?
Oh, absolutely. Concrete poetry has been like a was like a massive kind of discovery for me, especially because I have more of a visual background to begin with. So I was an art student, a visual art student, and I studied graphic design. And while I was studying graphic design, I also started to write and perform poetry. And there was a moment in which I thought, okay, what is the connection between these two things I'm so excited about? To say things in a really sort of like rapid way, that's how I ended up looking into concrete poetry, and that's how I ended up going to Writers Forum.
I think we should explain. Writers Forum, as I understand it, was a kind of workshop for experimental poetry, which was founded by Bob Cobbing, who was a experimental poet and artist in many respects. He was a visual artist, a sound poet, a performance poet, and a huge experimenter in the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s. So he was quite a pioneer of many interdisciplinary poetry forms. And I believe he also published a book that was very influential for you. Is that right?
Word score utterance
Yes.
choreography?
Yeah, right.
Yes. Oh yeah,
Right.
but I was actually going to say that that is the word that changed like everything for me.
Okay,
It was like edited in like in I think in the 90s, and it's all about how to perform visual poems and whether they should be performed, and if so, how. Definitely it changed my whole practice, and I never got over it. And I don't
yeah, so
want
that's
to.
great,
I don't want to ever get over this book. It's absolutely magical.
I think we should put it in the show notes so people can find it somehow. I don't know if it's if you can get it anywhere now, but at least there should be some information about it somewhere.
Yeah, Writers Forum. Well, first of all, there were two Writers Forums for a while. I don't know if you've heard about this, but there was a schism after Bob passed away, and so there ended up being Writers Forum, which was run by Lawrence Upton, and then Writers Forum New Series, which now still exists after Lawrence Upton passed away a few years ago. And so when I went to Writers Forum, I went to both Writers Forum workshops, which is a little bit controversial.
So is it more like a performance space or is it more like a workshop thing?
So what is Writers Forum? So Writers Forum is a meeting where poets kind of gather and share work with each other, and the idea is that it's sort of part of this kind of like experimental tradition. So people are it's almost maybe a bit like, and I don't know if people would like this comparison, but scientists meeting and sharing the experiments that they've been working on. It's very democratic. Everyone, gets a time to share their work and also possibly perform their work with other people. If there are sort of like polyvocal pieces, that's also possible to do. And then there's like discussions about these works afterwards.
Yeah, I think it's quite a unique institution. I've been there once when it was run by Lawrence Upton. I remember that. And I don't think there's anything similar, like in Germany. I don't see anything, especially for experimental poetry. But that's a kind of a detour we made right now, because I wanted to ask you about something else before we delve in one more performance by you. And that is your interesting connection between opening up the poetry for performance art, for visual things, and for these constraints. But you also have these connection with with objects and like poetic objects. I don't know if it's hard to describe what they are really. Is this is the object poeticizing the language, or is the language poeticizing the object? So there's an interesting relation between object and language.
For me, it's all about thinking about how poetry, how a poem, or how a text actually can sort of exist in a way which is different from the kind of like traditional codex form, the kind of form of the book, which has pages. The pages start at the top and they end at the bottom, and at the end there's one last page and then the book is closed, and that's it really. And it's maybe a little bit strange me describing this, but because it's something we all know, but I do think that it's strange that that's how we mostly encounter text. Of course there's also a completely different relationship to text that we have on a screen and like online, and like scrolling is like different from turning pages, etc. But basically I'm really interested in this idea of trying to see how certain texts can fit in different forms, or what texts could work in specific forms that are maybe non-linear and less kind of prescriptive and more sort of like malleable and sort of like changeable than texts that have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And so yeah, that's kind of like led me to create different kinds of poetic objects, most of which are meant to be activated through performance.
Maybe we can have
And
some examples. What kind of objects did you do?
yeah, of course. So for example, I've got a piece that's called Spill, which involves 280 ping pong balls, and each one has one stanza on it, and that stanza can start at any of three points. So there are a very great number of different sort of like sequences for the piece, for this big poem. And what I liked about this was the idea of creating a poem that never had a fixed form to begin with. It wasn't about deconstructing a poem that I'd written to begin with and sort of like allowing it to become other things. So of course this is inspired by Raymond Queneau's 100 000 milliards de poèmes, and which I love, but I also I felt like it would be so much more exciting with this piece for it to not have like these specific poems that exist at the start, for it to never have had like a specific sequence that it followed. So that's one of them. And then I've got like a piece which is called Bolts, and that involves lots of small, tiny, maybe like they can be described as like tiny tubes with text inside them, and this piece is performed with magnetic gloves. So this involves like 421 sort of small objects that are then picked up by the magnetic gloves, and that's going to kind of like influence the order in which the words are read. I've got also like a piece called Coil, which is like a 7 meter long ribbon of text. And then I also produce this piece called Soliflores, which involves 30 different sort of chimes, each making a different note, and each poem is housed within these kind of like its own sort of like metal tube and has its own kind of sound. And that piece is also performed in, a different order every time.
There's a lot of things. You didn't even mention all of them, but some of them you can see online on YouTube and on Vimeo, I think. You have and on your website you have some links to these performances. The object is very important also for your poetry, but also like the physical aspect, the body. I think the body and the voice is very important. And all of this, it strikes me that it's really a big contrast to any digital poetry. It's not digital. There is no computers involved. It's very straightforward, simple. Well, the basic ideas are always simple, but in the end, it gets quite complex, you know? So, and it looks like a lot of work in the end. And it looks like you're really like like a worker of poetry, you know, and with a working suit and everything. And why is it so important to have these physical aspects? Why didn't you go into like digital areas or virtual areas? Or would you like to go there?
Yeah, the reason that I'm interested in producing these objects is because what I'm trying to do with them is to create some new and sort of like different ways of experiencing text for an audience. And I found that when I've been an audience member, sort of, watching a performance that involves objects that are maybe, involve texts that are not linear, that it's well, it makes the contingency of the form visible. So, when I'm performing my piece Spill with these 280 spheres around me and picking them up one by one, I think the audience inevitably becomes aware that it's impossible for me to know exactly what I'm going to read next. I can't have planned the order in which the piece is read. And I think that that kind of changes the fact that this idea of the poet and performer not knowing what the form of the piece is going to be in performance and kind of discovering it alongside the audience, I think that that creates a different dynamic between performer and audience. And I like this these kind of like opportunities to be closer to the audience and to kind of maybe like lessen the sort of intense, almost kind of like hierarchical divide that usually exists between, or that traditionally would exist between a great poet reading from their great book on a stage, or maybe, yeah, even in front of a lectern, and the audience kind of listening and potentially trying to grasp the great truth that this great poet is communicating through their poetry. So it's a bit of a reaction against that dynamic.
And there's one other thing I wanted to ask you before that, because I forgot about it. And that's the role of humor. I think you do have quite a bit of humor in your work, but it's not extremely obvious. It's a little bit like underground humor. It just comes after a while. So you do this on purpose, or so is it some kind of subversive method?
I like this question about like whether I do it on purpose because in some ways no.
Because it sometimes looks very, very serious how you do it, you know?
This is something that's actually really a really important part of my practice is that quite a few of my projects started off as a joke. And then
Okay.
what I really like to do is start with this joke and kind of be conscious that it's absurd, and then take it super seriously and then just kind of like commit to this absurd situation or this absurd idea. You know, until the very end of you know, either the project or the performance. And sometimes it also comes from, you know, maybe jokes in conversation, joking about something. The other thing is, which is really important, that you know, laughter for me is such a fascinating kind of a reaction to have to work. And for example, with the piece I performed at the beginning of this podcast, Nothing Intensifies with the pump, there have been you know, situations in which people have re received this piece in a really kind of like serious way. And then there's also been, you know, one particular situation in which people were laughing out loud throughout the performance of that piece. And I find that so kind of like it's so kind of like affirming. It's such a wonderful kind of reaction to have because it's so visceral. And I think there are so many different things that provoke laughter. And in my own experience as an audience member, the first time I ever saw someone perform sound poetry, for example, I'd never heard of sound poetry before at all, and I was at the Bob Cobbing maybe Memorial Conference. I think that's what it was called. Perhaps it was in 2016. Anyway, someone performed one of Bob's sound poems. You know, I knew I was surrounded by people I didn't know who'd probably be taking this quite seriously. So I thought, no, don't laugh now. You know, you want to talk to these people afterwards because they have some really interesting, you know, things that you want to kind of like that you would love for them to share with you. So don't laugh because it'll look like you're not taking this seriously. And I really tried not to laugh, and I it was impossible. And I just kind of it, the laughter just exploded, and there was no other way around it. And of course, like for me, this laughter wasn't about thinking it was ridiculous. It was about this kind of like intense, the intensity of sound poetry. And yeah, and of course, when I told this story to people afterwards who had, you know, who had more sort of experiences as audience members with sound poetry, everyone said, you know, of course it's okay to laugh, that any reaction is valid. And I think that's also kind of really important is, you know, for various kind of to leave space for a variety of reactions.
And I think it's also very important in connection with experimental art, because people think, especially experimental art, is difficult. It's very far out, and you have to take it seriously, even if you don't understand it. And yeah, I think it's very, very important to have this reaction, to allow this reaction, especially with experimental art, and because experimenting means, yeah, you're trying out things, and of course it's fine to laugh about it. Yeah, I think we're ready maybe to hear some more performance. And we talked about the importance of audience for your work, but in this next piece you don't have an audience, or actually you are your own audience like this. You're talking to yourself, isn't it?
Yeah, so this piece, when it was first performed, was live streamed as a kind of Facebook performance during the pandemic, and yeah, then it was really just me performing to myself, although people were then able to experience it as well, and that's very much kind of like embedded in the piece, yeah.
Okay, so maybe we'll just start with that.
Oh. Iris. Oh, it's you, Iris. Yes, it's me, Iris, and you, Iris. Yes, it's us. Just us, Iris. Isn't it? Isn't it, Iris? Yes, it is, Iris. Yes. It's just you, Iris, and me, Iris. Yes, Iris. Yes, it is. It was just Just like this, wasn't it? Yesterday, Iris. Oh, yes, Iris. Yesterday, too, Iris. Just like this, Iris. It was, wasn't it, Iris? Yes, it was. And before that, Iris. Yes, Iris. Before that, too, Iris. Just us, Iris. Just us, and again, Iris. And today, Iris. Yes. It often is. Often is. Isn't it is? Isn't it is these days? Yes, I guess I. Now you mention I. Yes, I guess I. Guess it is. Well, Iris. Yes, Iris. Well, Iris. Well, I guess we'd better guess we'd yes, better get yes, get on with it then. Yes, I yes. Well, Iris, I do hope you're ready, Iris. Yes, Iris. Yes. You know I'm yes. You yes, you know I'm yes. Yes, I know. Right. So let's yes, get on with yes. Let's do that. But you're not. But we're not doing it now. We're just about to. Oh, good, Iris. Yes. So are you ready? Yes. All right then. Yes, Iris. Let's yes. But don't you? Isn't it rather? Well, quite. Yes, that's because. Yes, it is just I. It's just us. You know. I know it's just you and we and yes. I think we've yes we yes so. So shall we? Yes. Should yes. Are you ready? Yes. We yes. We should. Shouldn't we? Should we? Should today again? Yes. Again. Just us and we. Yes, Iris. Yes. And now it's yes. It's time to yes. Yes. I know, but it didn't know. Didn't used to know. You know to be no, Iris. No. This way did it? Did it? Didn't. But do you, you know, do you know what? Well, what? Do you remember what? Well, Iris, what? Remember, do you what? Well, what do I what? What? Don't you remember? Remember what, Iris? Well, Iris, do you I what? Remember when, what, when? Well, Iris, when, well, what, well, when, you know. Don't think I do, Iris. You know when? No, Iris. No, I don't. Well, don't. Well, don't just what? Just what? Don't what? Well, don't just don't. I don't. But you know, I don't even know what you, Iris. What? What, Iris? Do you remember? Remember what, Iris? What? Well, when? What, Iris? Come on, Iris. No, you come on, Iris. When it? When it wasn't. No. Oh. Well, I. Yes. I guess we. Yes. We better just. Yes. Let's just. Yes. Let's. Iris. Yes, Iris. Iris. Let's just us. Just us, Iris. Yes, Iris. Yes. Again. I know, but let's just. But you really don't. When it wasn't just. I don't, you know, I really don't. And I wish you, we, I wish you, we, I wish we could just, yes, I know. I know, you know, I know. I know. Yes, Iris. Yes, Iris. Yes. So let's, yes, Iris. Yes, Iris. Let's. So why, what? Why aren't we what, Iris? We are we, do we really? Yes, Iris. Yes. Yes, we do. All right then, Iris. Can we just what, Iris? What? Well, 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 what? What? Well, what if? What? What if? What? Can you just what? Why can't you what? Well, I just well. What if? What? Well, with you, it's. What? Yes, I yes know you. Okay, just right. So now just what if we I well if look if we just you if I can't. But we it's I know. So
Yes, I just you always do. You do. I just well, but I guess yes, it is. Yes, again, yes, might, yes, might as well. Can we? No. I what you what? I what I just it really just is it still is yes, Iris. Well, what? Well, what? Well, just you we I wish what? Well, Iris, what Iris, what Iris, what? Oh.
Yeah, talking about humor in your work, this is an incredibly funny piece, definitely, and really reflecting also the pandemic loneliness somehow. Talking to yourself, did you ever perform it in front of an audience also?
Yes, I've performed it in front of an audience since, and so I had to think about how to kind of like adapt the way that it was, built for an online performance to begin with. And the way I've done that is by using a tablet that's roughly the size of kind of like a mirror, and holding it up like a mirror to kind of keep this sense of like. Talking to myself, but in a more kind of like physical context.
There's one more thing I really wanted to ask, and that's about your collaboration, because you're really a collaborative artist and you do a lot of collaborations. But I just saw there is some two collaborations that were very specific to me. Now there was the one you have in the duo Soft Play, which is also talking about humor, taking the humor even further, where I think you try out some slapstick kind of things, and that's very strange. Maybe can you say something about that? What kind of a collaboration is that, or what kind of performances are these?
Yeah, so Soft Play is my duo with Paul Ingram, and we're working between kind of like experimental theater and performance art, and there are also some sort of like slapstick elements, as you said. So the most slapstick kind of piece that we've got is called Argument, and yeah, I don't want to spoil it too much, but yeah, I mean, yeah, it was a situation in which we both had to learn to slap someone in the face multiple times. So when we were rehearsed this piece, for example, that was a really interesting learning curve. It's really funny to talk about slapping your friend as in performance as a as a casual thing, and then when you actually have to rehearse that, it's much more difficult. But that was just a small, very small side note. But yeah, with Soft Play, we work with like a set of objects that come back in different performance pieces. We have a typeface that we always use. It's which is Comic Sans. So whenever there's a visual element of text that the audience can see, it's always Comic Sans. So that in our piece Welcome, for example, we have signs that are written in Comic Sans. I guess some of the themes that we're exploring are like different sort of like relationships between individuals. So we call our characters A and B. So A and B are in different sort of like situations, and there's a different dynamic between them in each piece, and our pieces also are often relate to work, and there's often an absurd sort of element to them. But yeah, the theme of sort of like labor and the absurd are important parts of what we do. And then we work with various props, and we have specific costumes that we always wear as well. So yeah, for example, we've got some of our props are more clown-like. So we've used balloons before. For example, which is kind of very obviously clown-esque. For example, we've used jugs of milk, bin bags, clipboards. Yes. So that that's another kind of object that we use, and these objects can come back in various pieces. And
And it's really great that as an kind of an experimental artist, you even experiment with slapstick and these kind of forms and comedy, which is very unique, I think. And there is another collaboration I would like to mention because maybe we can hear something of that at the end of the podcast. And it's the collaboration with Daryl Worthington in a project called Something Happened. That's quite different, I think, isn't it?
it's a duo with Darryl Worthington, who is a musician, who works with electronics and objects and also some sounds made with guitar. So we've been working together for just 2.5 years. The sort of starting point of our duo, which is a text sound duo, was to do with trying to find ways in which sound and text can emerge simultaneously instead of, for example, him writing a song, the music for a song, and me writing the lyrics, or me writing a poem and him making some kind of like background music for it. So we're really interested in this idea of kind of things emerging at the same time, these two materials, text and sound, kind of responding to each other in the moment, evolving together in response to each other.
So let's hear something of this collaboration by Iris Cullomb and Daryl Worthington.
We always assume that flying creatures have complete control, but they don't, right? They're subjected to all these other forces going around them. Maybe it just got sucked in. Retrieve it. The sting stays.
So this was a short piece called Sting from the forthcoming album Buzz by Iris Cullomb and Daryl Worthington as Something's Happening. Just one more thing about collaborations. It really strikes me that most of your collaborations are actually duo projects, is it? Or is it easier to work as a duo or as a bigger group than in a bigger group?
So I mean, I have also worked in bigger groups. For example, I mean, the biggest group that I'm a part of is London Improvisers Orchestra, which involves like really very many people, perhaps like a 30-ish at a time. But I do tend to work in duos often. I mean, I like interacting with people one-on-one. So maybe that just kind of like is it just slips into my approach in an art context to collaboration as well. But I'm also in a project which is a trio, which is a punk band called Daylight Bulb, and there's three of us in that, so that's another exception.
It's just incredible how many projects you have. How do you manage to coordinate all this?
I am quite organized, and I'm used to kind of like going from working on one thing to something totally different quite quickly. But because I'm always sort of, I also have several jobs at the same time as well. But also, I guess with collaborations, like it's adapting to each other's kind of like availability and time, and so like sometimes one duo or one collaborative project is going to be sort of like evolving in a way which is more regular, and sometimes that changes, and it all kind of really just depends on.
So what is the most active project you have right now?
Well, actually, this week it's where the past couple of weeks I have been doing a lot of them at the same time. So, like, I've got some things happening with some things happening, and I've been working with Paul Ingram on some on soft play, because we're now writing down, we're kind of like shaping our pieces into a sort of like collection of plays. And I've also been rehearsing with Daylight Bulb as well.
We're about to finish this podcast, and for the end, you also brought some kind of poetry recommendation with you.
Yes. So the artist that I'd like to mention here, I don't know if they would necessarily define themselves as a poet, although they are. I think they do define themselves as a sound poet, among other things. And it's Nicola Woodham, who is an experimental musician working with voice and electronics as well, between kind of improvisation and composition. I really find her work fascinating, and there's quite a lot available on her website. But yeah, I think her approach to sound and to voice and improvisation and the various themes that she explores really is fascinating to me, and I really admire her work.
Okay, great. We'll put all this information in the show notes. Thank you so much for taking your time for this podcast, Iris. I hope you will come over to Germany sometime. This was the podcast Possible Poetry with Iris Kollump and some examples of your work. And you can listen to this podcast on all major podcast platforms, of course, on Spotify and also on YouTube. And YouTube has the great advantage you can put in the subtitle function for easier understanding. And you can get all the info and complete show notes on the Possible Poetry blog on Podigee. That's where we are hosted. And if you don't want to miss new episodes, please subscribe to Possible Poetry and the Podigee blog. And if you're in Frankfurt, actually, we do have a poetry window, and it will probably display some of your works there at the poetry window, some videos, and you said you are also sending some books or pamphlets over so we can have them. To finish off, I have to thank Kulturamt Frankfurt for supporting this podcast. Once again, thank you so much for taking your time, Iris.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been really wonderful, and thank you.
Possible Poetry.